The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So I want to welcome you tonight to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Dr. Val Arkush, and I have the really wonderful honor of chairing the Free Library's Healthcare Advisory Council. The Healthcare Advisory Council was started several years ago when the library did some polling of the people who use the facility, and they learned that about 30% of the people who were coming to the library at that time were coming here to get answers to some kind of healthcare-related question. It was an astonishing number and one that prompted the library to form the Healthcare Advisory Council. So that council has been meeting ever since, and we've helped the library broaden out the training of staff to help people understand how to do searches to result in good outcomes for finding health information, get connected to physicians, learn about health insurance, all sorts of health-related matters. So it's been a real honor to do this work. As many of you know, the Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity, from its award-winning author events series to its access to health information and resources. Please visit freelibrary.org/support to make a gift that will help the library continue to produce such transformative programming. And while you're online, don't forget to sign up for a library card. They still exist in various forms, and you need one. So it's now my pleasure to introduce someone who I have just enormous personal respect for, and someone who I did not know early in my career, but have gotten to know in the last several years. I'm a physician. I practice medicine here in Philadelphia for a little over 20 years, and Dr. Offutt was someone that I and all of my friends and colleagues looked up to. The director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and a professor of vaccinology and pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, Dr. Offutt is the co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine and a founding advisory board member of the Autism Science Foundation. His many honors include election to the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences. He is the author of more than 140 papers and 6 books, including The Cutter Incident, Autism's False Prophets, and Bad Faith. And I have to say that I so admire Dr. Offutt, not only for his science, but for his bravery. He was always willing to speak truth to those that were trying to bring him down, and it's a tough position to be in, and he certainly deserves all of our respect. The book that he'll discuss tonight is called Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. Now, I have a little confession to make here, and it was really ironic when I was asked to give this introduction. I was asked to do it because I'm chair of the Healthcare Advisory Council. However, I'm also an elected office holder right next door in Montgomery County, and I'm a doctor. So I'm looking at the title of this book, and I'm thinking, is this a message? Is this a subliminal message? So I'm particularly interested to hear what this physician that I have respected so much in my professional lives, both of them, both as a physician and as an elected official, has to say this evening. This is a really interesting book that pushes back against the pervasiveness of pseudoscientists, quacks, charlatans, and dangerously misinformed advocates. So I'm hoping I'm not in any of those categories. We are so pleased to have Dr. Offutt here with us this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Paul Offutt to the Free Library.
Thank you, Dr. Arkush. I think that science and health communications is at a crossroads, and in many ways a dangerous crossroads. I think the problem is that we have drifted from scientific illiteracy into science denialism. People now simply declare their own truths. So, for example, that vaccines cause autism, or that climate change is a hoax created by the Chinese, or that evolution and creationism are equally valid hypotheses. To believe all of these things, you have to deny an enormous amount of data. And as a consequence, I think science is losing its rightful place as a source of truth. So before I sort of get into the details of this, I wanted to sort of take a step back and define science, to say essentially what it is and what it isn't. So this from Edmund Wilson's Consilience: science is the systematic enterprise of gathering knowledge about the world and organizing and condensing that knowledge into testable laws and theories. So the key word there is testable. I mean, you can determine whether or not, for example, MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine causes autism. That can be determined in a scientific venue. It's distinct from how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. That's not a scientific question. It's a theological question. It is not going to be answered in a scientific venue. And so what we do as scientists is we formulate a hypothesis, establish burdens of proof, subject those proofs to statistical analysis. Science is basically a study of controls that allows one to isolate the effects of a single variable. What it isn't is it isn't scientists, it isn't scientific bodies, or it isn't accumulated knowledge. I mean, science is really just a way of thinking about or approaching a problem. I mean, as we learn, as we go, scientists are willing to take textbooks and throw them over their shoulders without a backward glance. I mean, scientists get it wrong all the time, but that's okay, because science is enormously self-correcting. So I'll give you some examples. In 1926, Johannes Fibinger believed that Spidoptera carcinoma, a worm he had identified, caused cancer, for which he won the Nobel Prize, even though, as it turned out, that was dead wrong. In 1935, Egas Moniz, a Portuguese neurologist, created a surgical cure for a variety of psychiatric illnesses. He called it leucotomy. When it crossed the Atlantic Ocean, the name was changed to lobotomy, where 20,000 lobotomies were performed. Interestingly, 7,000 were performed by one man, a man named Walter Jackson Freeman, who lived not that far from here. He was a Philadelphian, went to Episcopal Academy, and he did far more harm than good as lobotomies basically faded away. The last lobotomies were done in the 1970s. Ansel Keys, in 1957, created what he called the heart-healthy diet. He was a famous nutritionist. He headed World Health Organization consulting groups, and as well as to the United Nations. He believed that saturated fats were bad, that unsaturated fats were good, and that therefore butter, which, you know, contained animal fat and therefore saturated fats, was bad. And he drove us then into margarine, which was partially hydrogenated vegetable oils, which was loaded with trans fats, and was estimated by the Harvard School of Public Health to have accounted for about 250,000 heart-related events every year, and ultimately caused Time magazine to change its cover. And then this one is one you might remember, Stanley Pons on the left, who actually looks remarkably like Bill Gates, but he's not, and Marty Fleischman on the right were chemists at the University of Utah who believed that if you took a palladium wire, attached it to a battery, put it into heavy water, so-called deuterium, that you could cause two small nuclei to fuse to form a larger nucleus, which released energy. This is exactly what happens on the sun, except the difference was they did this at room temperature. And the name for this, the hyphenated name for this, was cold fusion. Good, you guys know. And this, too, died the death it deserved. I mean, it should have bothered people that this violated the first law of thermodynamics, which is that you can't get more energy out of something than you put into it, which is why you'll never see a perpetual motion machine. But in any case, it didn't. We wanted to believe this. This was right around the time, if you remember, of the Exxon Valdez disaster, and we wanted to believe that there was the possibility of a clean, limitless source of energy, even though it didn't make a whit of physiological sense. But I think people are upset by this. I think the fluidity of science, the fact that it is always self-correcting, is disconcerting. And so, for example, what I would call the Bones-McCoy seduction. So Bones-McCoy, for those of you who remember, was the chief medical officer on the USS Enterprise. When you had a particular set of signs and symptoms, he did this. If you look in his hand, he has something called a tricorder. He would sort of scan you up and down. He would then look at the readout, and that's what you had. There was no doubt about it. And you know, I think I think if you ask people today whether or not we're going to know more about science and health than we do now, 100 years from now, will we know more? I think most people would say, yes, we will know more. But when it comes to your illness, you would like to believe we know everything we need to know now, even though that's not true. And so I think what ends up happening is that we're seduced by the guru. And so Mehmet Oz is a guru. I mean, he doesn't express doubt. He says things in absolutely certain terms. He's launched here by Oprah Winfrey. Deepak Chopra also sort of functions in many ways as a guru. And even somebody like Andrew Wakefield, who was of the belief that the combination measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism, remains a guru, even though there are now 17 studies that have clearly shown you were at no greater risk of getting autism if you got this vaccine or if you didn't. Still, there he has his followers. And if you watch him sort of go from venue to venue, and there was a movie called The Pathological Optimist that actually launched last year, briefly, it didn't get much of a run, but if you watch that movie, you'll see that people treat him as a god in many ways. I mean, they sort of gather around him and just want to touch the hem of his coat, to sort of stick to the New Testament analogies. But so now, given that, I mean, who should really be the persons or persons who communicate science to the public? And I think the answer to that question is the people who know the most about it, which are, you know, the scientists or clinicians who work in that field. Unfortunately, I think there are many things that work against them. So, for example, the scientific method, something that all scientists are trained in. So I'll give you an example of how this works. If you're trying to determine whether or not the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine causes autism, you form something called the null hypothesis, which is to say MMR vaccine does not cause autism. You can do two things with that null hypothesis. You can reject it, which is to say that when autism follows receipt of MMR vaccine, it occurs at a level greater than would be expected by chance alone. Or you cannot reject it, which is to say that when autism follows receipt of MMR vaccine, it occurs at a level that would be expected by chance alone. But you can never accept the null hypothesis, which is to say you can never prove never. And I think that that's difficult. So, for example, when I was a little boy, I used to watch the television show Adventures of Superman. That was starring George Reeve. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember this, but, you know, George Reeve flew. He put his arms out in front of him with this interlocking thumb grip, which I thought was sort of key to the whole navigational experience. And he would go to the left or he would go to the right, and his cape would fly behind him, and he would look at the cities passing him below. He flew. When you're 5 years old, television does not lie. And so, you know, I went into the backyard, and I sort of put a towel around myself. This was, I don't know if any of you saw recently the Mr. Rogers movie, but they talk about this in the movie where kids actually did do what I did, although I did it from a much smaller height, and hurt themselves. But I went and tried from a very small height to fly, and, you know, spoiler alert, I was unsuccessful. That didn't prove I couldn't fly. I mean, I could have done it a million times. That would have only made it all the more statistically unlikely. You can't prove that there weren't weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You can only say that there were nowhere that you looked. You can't prove that there weren't, that I've never been to Juneau, Alaska. Even though I've never been to Juneau, Alaska, you can only show a series of buildings in Juneau, Alaska with me not standing next to them. So I think the way that this plays out in the real world was evidenced by actually Dan Burton, who was a Republican from Indiana that headed in the early 2000s the Committee on Government Reform. He had a grandchild who had autism, and he believed that vaccines caused it. So he brought a number of panelists into that committee hearing, including Andrew Wakefield, and I actually participated on the other side, as did a epidemiologist from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention named Colleen Boyle. And she was great. I think she did as good as one could do to try and explain the science. And she's basically said all the evidence to date doesn't support the hypothesis that MMR vaccine or other vaccines cause autism. But she didn't say what she needed to say, which is MMR doesn't cause autism. Because to him, he heard waffling, and he got really angry and said, "So, you can't tell me that MMR doesn't cause autism because you just don't know, do you?" And not just waffling, but ultimately like she was covering something up. You could see his anger. And while she was dedicated to the scientific method, knowing you can never say never, I think that ultimately hurt her when she was trying to communicate science in that venue to the subcommittee. I think the other thing that we are up against is how the scientist is perceived. So in 1982, David Chambers, an Australian educator, asked 4,800 elementary school students to draw a picture of a scientist. In each case, the scientist wore a white lab coat, had unkempt, tousled hair, peered out from behind thick, dark-rimmed glasses, and was male. Now, this was more than 30 years ago. I'd like to think they would not draw only males anymore, but that is what was true then. I think if you Google the term scientist, this is often the image that you see. And so where does this come from? There's an author named Christopher Frayling who wrote a book called Mad, Bad, and Dangerous, The Science and the Cinema. And he argues that the wild hair comes from the world's most famous scientist, Albert Einstein, sort of the human symbol of genius. And although there are many other famous scientists, Einstein's universal popularity, argues Frayling, lies in his simple, easy-to-remember formula, E equals MC squared. He argues that the white lab coat is a symbol of neutrality, cleanliness, and most importantly, separation from the rest of the world, and standards usually male of professionalism. That the Coke bottle glasses are often an outward and visible sign of the scientist's perceived incompleteness as a human being, a short-sightedness that cuts him or off from the mainstream. And I think worst of all, this from Theodore Roszak, an historian. In the worst case, the scientist is seen as someone who creates monsters, either literal, like Frankenstein, or figurative, like genetically modified organisms. Quote, in these images resides a legitimate public fear of the scientist's stripped down, depersonalized perception of knowledge, the child of power without spiritual intelligence. Interestingly, Aaron Eckhart, when he played a geophysicist in the movie The Core, spent a couple months with actual geophysicists and was amazed that they were pretty much just like everybody else. He actually wrote about it, that they had the same concerns as everybody else, that they procreated and had families. I mean, this was like surprising him. And when you think about it, only about 0.3% of the American population are basic scientists, lab scientists. So many people don't know scientists, and so they have these sort of fixed images of them. The good news is that this was a Gallup poll trying to answer the question or ask people the question, do you think that this particular group contributes to society? And so 84% of respondents believe that the military did contribute, 77% that teachers contribute, 70% that scientists contributed, 69% that medical doctors contributed, 64% that engineers contributed, 40% that clergy contributed, 38% that journalists contributed, 31% that artists contributed, 23%, a remarkably high percentage actually, believe that lawyers contributed. Sorry, Deb, 21% that business executives contributed. They didn't ask about politicians because what would be the point? I think the other challenge is the scientist's personality. This is an old joke, but still plays. How can you tell the difference between introverted scientists and extroverted scientists? When introverted scientists talk to you, they stare down at their shoes. When extroverted scientists talk to you, they stare down at your shoes. I mean, scientists generally are often shy, quiet, introverted, and thoughtful, much more comfortable working in isolation than carousing in public. You don't typically find scientists doing stand-up comedy, appearing on reality television shows, or screaming shirtless in sub-freezing weather at football games, with the exception of Eagles games, huh? How about those Philadelphia Eagles? This is actually being carried on C-SPAN. I just want to make that point, and also to make the point that the New England Patriots were evil and deserved to lose. Okay, just so we've got that out there. So take a look at this picture. This is Larry King Live. And to the left is Jenny McCarthy. To the right is a man named David Taylor, who at the time was the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Now, David Taylor he's an excellent pediatrician, and he went onto the show to try and calm the waters about whether or not vaccines caused autism. But this was not his venue. Jenny McCarthy is an actress. She is vivid. She's imaginative. She's dramatic. She's not an A-level actress, but an actress nonetheless. And you can look at the body language. I mean, she dominated this conversation. She's leaning forward and making her point while David is literally sort of back on his heels, uncomfortable in this kind of venue. He, David, is used to sort of being in scientific or medical venues where people share ideas, discuss facts, come to reasonable conclusions, not this. This was drama. This was a passion play, and it wasn't one that he wasn't really ready for. I think the other challenge is that there are shrinking opportunities. By 2008, the number of science articles in American newspapers had shrunk by two-thirds. That same year, CNN dismissed its entire science, space, and technology unit. The Boston Globe eliminated its science section, choosing to cover health and fitness instead. Less than 2% of nightly newscasts include any mention of science. I mean, I watch the news all the time. I can't think recently of when science has been covered. The other issue, I think, is the soundbite problem. It's very hard to take a complex subject and reduce it to a soundbite. I mean, so for example, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, was born the notion that a mercury-containing preservative in vaccines could cause mercury toxicity or developmental delays or autism. You have to really understand a fair amount of data to calm the waters on that, to know that if you live on the planet Earth, that you're going to be exposed to levels of mercury in anything that is made from water, including breast milk and infant formula, than you're ever going to get from vaccines. That there are 7 studies that have looked at children who got vaccines that contained mercury, compared them to children that got the same vaccines that didn't contain mercury, to find that the incidence of mercury toxicity or signs or symptoms of mercury toxicity, et cetera, were the same in both groups. It's a complicated subject. And so, you know, you find yourself saying things like, you know, babies are exposed to far more mercury in just by having drinking breast milk or infant formula than they're ever going to get from vaccines. That's not exactly reassuring. I mean, that all you're doing is sort of confirming the notion that people are caught in this environmental hell. Or you can say that the studies have shown that you're at no greater risk if you've gotten these vaccines than if you haven't. But, you know, mercury never sounds good. It is truly at high levels and toxic to the nervous system. And the minute you say that word, really, you've lost. I had to testify in front of congressional subcommittees where I've heard congressmen, you know, say, when it comes to mercury, I have zero tolerance. Well, if you have zero tolerance for mercury, you've got to move to another planet, because on this planet, there's mercury, and you're going to be exposed to it. Much as you're exposed to other heavy metals like thallium, beryllium, or arsenic. I mean, we all have those heavy metals circulating in our bloodstream because we live on the Earth's crust, right? All of us live on the Earth's crust. I think the good news is that scientists, I think, are good stories. They certainly have a story to tell. And there are many examples of this. The Galileo Galilei, who was lived between 1564 and 1642, and in 1610, he published his observations about the phases of Venus, the moons around Jupiter, and hundreds of previously unseen stars in the Milky Way. And so when he published his monograph, he called it The Starry Messenger. What a great title, right? He didn't call it like planetary observations. I mean, the notion is that not only was he observing the stars, but at some level, they were observing him. It was an interesting and dramatic title. Mary Shelley in 1818 was fascinated in the early 1800s by the fact that electricity was popularized in county fairs and expositions. People were amazed when they saw their hair stand on end or when they saw a dead frog's leg twitch. She was especially amazed when she saw that dead frog's leg twitch. And so as an 18-year-old, she was so impressed that she wrote the book Frankenstein. It's alive. Or Louis Pasteur was a showman, much more of a showman than I think he was given credit for. In 1881, he separated sheep, goats, and cows at a county fair into two groups. To one group, he gave an anthrax vaccine. To the other, he gave nothing. 30 days later, he infected both groups with anthrax bacteria. All in the vaccinated group survived. All in the control group died. Two right in front of the crowd, two gasps as those animals passed away. And there are many scientists who I think have been excellent ambassadors to the field, people like Isaac Asimov, who's a biochemist, Jacques Cousteau, who's an oceanographer, Siddhartha Mukherjee and Atul Gawande, who are physicians, Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Dawkins are evolutionary biologists, Bill Nye, the science guy, is a mechanical engineer, Albert Einstein and Stephen Hawking are theoretical physicists, and they have all been excellent storytellers. My favorite line, actually, from Jacques Cousteau, is he says that that whether we believe or not, all of us believe in luck, because how else could we explain good things that happen to people we don't like? So now to sort of get to sort of the meat here is in terms of communicating science to the public, I'm just going to go through a number of stories that to some extent I experienced. I don't know if you remember the Berenstain Bears book. Remember the Berenstain Bears, sort of these anthropomorphized grizzly bears where the father would always do something wrong that would be the way that he would educate his family. This is that. So, in September 2007, Jenny McCarthy appeared on Oprah. I was actually asked to be on the show, and here's the way it played out. The Oprah Winfrey, so when I was asked to be on the show, you think, you know, I probably know more about vaccines than Jenny McCarthy and Oprah Winfrey. This is a chance to calm the waters, but that's not what this show is about. Oprah is there to tell a story, and her story has three roles: the hero, the victim, and the villain. Jenny's the hero. Her son, who has autism, or she believed had autism, was the victim. This leaves only one role for you, the villain. And you basically, you know, you're going on to a show to basically tell two women that they're wrong, that Jenny McCarthy is wrong, that vaccines don't cause autism, that Oprah, by extension, was wrong to have her on the show in front of a studio audience of basically 100% women. It's not exactly a home field advantage there. And, you know, Jenny's dramatic. You know, she says, you know, my child was fine. Then the doctor, you know, pulled out that shot, and he said, that's the autism shot, isn't it? And the doctor, she said, screamed at her, which I don't believe. Pediatricians do not scream at people. They get screamed at. We're wimps, basically. We don't really use scream at people. But he screamed at me, and then my child got that shot. And within seconds, the soul left his eyes. And, you know, she's fighting back tears, telling that story. You don't go on that show. I didn't go on the show because it's a mistake. And I think... that's sort of the lesson, is don't go on a show when the host isn't on your side. This, I think of all the things, actually, that I have done with the media, this is the one thing that I would like to take back. It's the thing I still think about, it still haunts me, and I'll tell you this story. It was actually the first time I was ever on television. At issue on Good Day Philadelphia was... Bruce Williams and his 11-year-old daughter, Whitney Williams, she had AIDS. The father believed that she had acquired human immunodeficiency virus from an oral polio vaccine. Now, at the time, the child had no other recognizable risk factors. She had never had a tattoo. She had never had a blood transfusion. As far as anybody knows, she never had sex. Both of her parents were HIV negative. I mean, how had she gotten HIV? Now, the father didn't make this up. There was an article in the Rolling Stone by Tom Curtis titled The Origin of AIDS, Was It an Act of God or an Act of Man? There was a book by Edward Hooper called The River, A Journey to the Source of HIV and AIDS. And both that article and that book basically made the same claims, which centered on Hillary Kaprowski and the oral polio vaccine. I don't know if any of you are Philadelphians that know that Dr. Kaprowski was the head of the Wistar Institute. He was also the first person to give a vaccine, oral polio vaccine by mouth, even before Albert Sabin did. And he gave it in the Belgian Congo in the 1950s. Now, the article and the book basically made these claims. The chimp cells that were used to make Kaprowski's polio vaccine contained simian immunodeficiency virus. That after people were inoculated with this simian immunodeficiency virus containing polio vaccine, that then mutated in their bodies to human immunodeficiency virus. And that consistent with this theory, HIV first appeared in the Belgian Congo in the 1950s. In truth, HIV did mutate from SIV, but that event didn't occur in the Belgian Congo in the 1950s. It occurred in Cameroon in the 1930s. Kaprowski's polio vaccine wasn't made from chimp cells. It was made from monkey cells. And chimps aren't monkeys, they're apes. Neither SIV nor HIV were ever detected by very sensitive polymerase chain reactions, which are ways of detecting small quantities of viral genome in the lots of Kaprowski's polio vaccine. Sort of all of these reasons add up to the fact that this is why Rolling Stone is not considered to be one of the great scientific or medical journals. Now, I didn't know the source of Whitney's HIV. I only knew what wasn't the source. And when the father got angry with me and the host got angry with me, I became more insistent. I was upset that they had used this child who clearly was suffering to put forward this ill-founded and frankly disproven belief. And the father was in the midst of suing the maker of the vaccine, the oral polio vaccine. And so I think while I was sort of caught up in those discussions, I really failed to express any sympathy for the girl. And, you know, this was 1993. The highly active antiretroviral drugs weren't available till 1996. I mean, 1993, if you had HIV, you were in trouble. And that was her story. I mean, she died in 1997, and eventually the father dropped his lawsuit when it became clear how she did acquire HIV, which, when you think about it, is the only way she could have acquired it. So I think the lesson here is be sympathetic, no matter how trying the circumstance. I think another example is when I was on Fox 29 Philadelphia in September 1997. It was back to school month, and I thought it would. The producer asked me to come and talk about vaccines before children went to school. The setup. Well, let me give you the setup first. So the setup was the producer thought it would be fun if instead of sitting sort of with the two hosts at their table, that I sit in the newsroom. That it would be more action. You know, that it would be people would be sort of buzzing around. So she's put me on this sort of high, unstable chair that sort of rocked with the slightest movement. As I was falling, I was about to fall over. There was a cameraman about 4 feet in front of my face. The newsroom was sort of buzzing, and there were people sort of laughing and talking. I think one person was screaming. Plus, this was 1997, so there was a television comedy drama called Ally McBeal, which starred Calista Flockhart. And she, the producer, was really interested in sort of the fashion statement that was being made by those women lawyers, and so she had four models who were standing next to me, each with progressively shorter skirts. So that was the setup. I mean, the question was, could it be any more distracting, really? And then sort of my earpiece fell out, and as I put it back in again, I was asked this question. Dr. Offa, could you tell us what vaccines children get, how many they get, and when they get them? Now, the actual answer to that question in 1997 is this. Children receive a vaccine to prevent hepatitis B vaccine at birth 1 and 6 months of age, with a combination DTP vaccine at 2, 4, 6, and 15 months of age, and again at 4 years of age, a vaccine to prevent Hib at 2, 4, 6, and 12 months of age, a polio vaccine at 2, 4, and 6 months of age, again at 4 years of age, and the combination MMR vaccine at 12 months and 4 years of age, and the chickenpox vaccine at 12 months of age. Now, there was no way I was going to be able to do this, not without a vaccine schedule in front of me. The better answer would have been children receive several vaccines in the first few years of life to prevent pneumonia, hepatitis, meningitis, and bloodstream infections, among others. Parents should make sure that their children are up to date on their vaccines so that they don't have to suffer these terrible diseases. I didn't give either of those answers. I sort of gave a variant of the first answer where I kind of got lost in the middle, forgetting which vaccines I had already said or how often they were given. It was pathetic. It was so pathetic, actually, that the model stopped talking and just stared at me sadly. It was bad. So I think the lesson here is you don't have to answer the question exactly as asked. This was another time I was on television. This was June 2013 with Nora O'Donnell on the left, Charlie Rose in the center. You remember Charlie Rose, and Gail King on the right. It had to do with a book that I'd written called Do You Believe in Magic, which was about sort of the sense and nonsense of alternative medicine. Gail King actually is the one who did the interview. When you're on television, especially, it's less so, I think, true with newspapers or radio, where they're more likely to have read your book. You're happy if they've just read the flap of your book. You're pretty happy if they've read the title of your book. But Gail King had read the whole book. She had the book sitting in front of her. She had tabs throughout the book. She asked a series of great questions, and we had a good discussion about how dietary supplements are an unregulated industry, about how megavitamins can do harm, and it was great until it wasn't. The reason it wasn't had to do with Steve Jobs. In the book, I talked about how Steve Jobs had pancreatic cancer, a pancreatic cancer he died from, but he didn't have a typical pancreatic cancer. He didn't have adenocarcinoma of the pancreas, which is sort of a almost uniformly fatal cancer. He had something called a neuroendocrine tumor that just happened to be in his pancreas. With early surgery, he had a 95% chance of survival. He didn't choose early surgery. Rather, he chose a variety of alternative treatments like coffee enemas, megavitamins, sort of fruit juices, until it was too late to do the surgery. And Charlie Rose was a good friend of Steve Jobs, and he really was angry that I had chosen to bring up Steve Jobs in his care. So we had this interaction. With respect to you, sir, isn't it dangerous to say if you've never treated a person what might or might not have been the consequence? Sir, by the way, is always bad, just as a tip. I'm sorry, I'm not understanding. I said, sort of this mild panic sets in. In other words, did you treat Jobs? No, I didn't. I said, so isn't it dangerous to suggest what he might have been able to do if you didn't treat him? This sort of, you know, you sort of get pulled into these rabbit holes, you know, where it doesn't really matter whether I treated Steve Jobs. The question is, were those facts that I stated correct? I mean, certainly Walter Isaacson in his book about Steve Jobs, or a number of newspaper and magazine articles, had said all the things that I just said to you about what was his choice of care and his choice to delay care and what was his actual pancreatic cancer. And so that's basically what I said. I mean, you know that neuroendocrine tumors have a 95% chance of survival with early surgery, and you know that he significantly delayed his surgery. You know that those two things, I think that up to the fact that he put himself at unnecessary risk by choosing an alternative course. So I think the lesson for me here, I guess, was, you know, don't go down the rabbit hole. It's easy to do that. You're often pulled away. You know, who funded that study? You know, what is your association with those funding groups? It's always about the data, the quality of the data, the internal consistency of the data, the reproducibility of the data. That's what's at issue. And you always get pulled into these other things, which you just have to try and avoid. Okay, this was another one. It was 60 Minutes in December of 2002. At issue was the George W. Bush administration wanted all frontline medical personnel to receive the smallpox vaccine. This request occurred months after the tragic events of September 11, 2001, and 1 year before the United States invaded Iraq. The administration was worried that smallpox would be used by rogue nations or rogue groups as a weapon of bioterror, and they knew that we have basically stopped giving the smallpox vaccine routinely to children in this country by 1972. We had generations of people in this country who hadn't been vaccinated, and they were worried that we were at risk. I was actually on the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices at the time that made that recommendation, and I voted against it. I voted against it because, for these reasons, the smallpox vaccine can be given post-exposure. Even after you've been exposed to somebody, you have at least 2 days before you have to make sure that you've gotten that vaccine. The smallpox is spread by large droplets that are generated from blisters in the mouth, so you really need face-to-face contact. You need to be within 5 feet of somebody face-to-face with smallpox to get it. It's not like measles. Measles is spread by small droplets, so if I have measles and stand here and then walk away, if anybody comes into my airspace within two hours, they could catch measles. That's not true of smallpox. You really have to have face-to-face contact. And it's never an asymptomatic infection. I mean, if you have smallpox, you have visible blisters on your face and your body. And the smallpox vaccine has a difficult safety profile, which is a nice way to say it. It can cause encephalitis, which is inflammation of the brain, pericarditis, which is inflammation of the sac that surrounds the heart, multi-system organ failure, and death in about 1 per million vaccinees. So my feeling at the time was, let's just wait. Let's instruct personnel on the vaccine. Let's instruct people how to give it. Let's make sure it's distributed. But let's wait until there's at least one case of smallpox somewhere on the face of this earth before we launch this program, because smallpox was eliminated from the face of this earth by the late 1970s. I was the only one that voted against that on the program. I think my lesson here was that when I was voting, I was actually writing something down. And when I looked up, I realized I was the only one that had voted against it. So that's the small lesson here. Look up when you vote. But so the person that interviewed me was Dan Rather. As you remember, Dan Rather, you know, sort of grilled. I'll just remember that moment when he was interviewing Richard Nixon, and it was in a large venue. And at one point, Richard Nixon said, this was actually about a month before Nixon actually left office, but Nixon said, are you running for something, Dan? And Rather said, this was at a time when you didn't routinely sort of vilify presidents, but Dan Rather looked back and said, no, Mr. President, are you? And that, you know, that sort of got laughter, but you know, this was an imposing figure, Dan Rather. So he came to visit my laboratory and to interview me about this issue. And so the thing that was worrisome here was that the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia receives federal funds. The hospital administrators were worried that I was about to appear on a national television show decrying a program that was supported by both the President of the United States and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They were comfortable with the interview as long as I didn't criticize the federal government directly, but stuck to the scientific argument. So it was nerve-wracking. Person who was the head of public relations at the time, a woman named Karen Muldoon-Geis, was great. I mean, she was a veteran. She'd been at Prime Star. She really knew what she was doing. But she didn't want me to say George W. Bush's name. And every time that Dan Rather said, well, if you were in the Oval Office and you were advising George W. Bush, what would you say? And she was, and lined herself, when I was looking at him, she was just over his right shoulder. So I could always see her doing this. But we got through the interview. Actually, Dan Rather was great. It was a winter day in January, I remember, and I brought the kids with me because I just wanted them to meet this iconic journalist. And he spent time with them, explained how journalism worked. They were about 8 and 10 at the time. He was really wonderful. So in any case, the lesson here is make sure you have the backing of your institution. So I think there are, fortunately, a number of forces that really work on behalf of science. The best, the clearly the best, without question, are the comedians. They are universally great on science. And I think it's because generally they're skeptics. They know nonsense when they see it, and so they're very quick to point it out. So I'll give you some example. This is a quote from George Bernard Shaw. If you're going to tell people the truth, make them laugh, otherwise they'll kill you. But they've all sort of had their different ways of doing it. Penn and Teller, for example, in 2010 sort of did this. Penn is Penn Jillette. He's the big guy that talks. Teller is the little guy that doesn't talk. And so he sort of sets up the plexiglass screen on one side that's protecting these bowling pins that represent children, and then the other side isn't protected. And then he takes this sort of plastic ball, and he keeps throwing it at both sides, where he correctly actually states, you know, this many children died of measles, this many children were paralyzed by polio, this many people, mothers were developed a rubella infection, which caused congenital birth defects. He went on and on, getting the epidemiology exactly right, screaming at the top of his lungs. So, I mean, whereas scientists would sort of in a drier way kind of go through those numbers, he did it in a way where you were riveted. It was great, this show. I was actually on the Colbert Report a couple times. This was nerve-wracking. I can tell you that sort of inoculating mice in a windowless room, concrete-blocked windowless room at Wistar for 20 years was not training for this in any way. But the way that Colbert works is he comes to you before the show and he says, look, I play a character. I'm going to stay in character the entire interview. Don't let my character get away with anything. If you do let my character get away for something, then it's going to be a boring interview. And they don't give you the questions beforehand, but they sort of they have the do's and don'ts of the Colbert Report. And so the one of the don'ts, interesting, was Atul Gawande, who is brilliant. I mean, he's a wonderful surgeon and writer. He's written a number of books, one of which was the Checklist Manifesto, and he was about sort of hospital, how hospitals can be more efficient. And he was on the Colbert Report. He was a don't. And the reason he was a don't was he kept coming back to his talking points. The fact of the matter is people don't go watch the Colbert Report to learn about hospitals, how hospitals can be more efficient. They go there to laugh at Stephen Colbert. Similarly, they don't want to learn about vaccines from you. They want to laugh at Stephen Colbert, largely at your expense. So get used to it. You're on a comedy show. If anybody happens to learn anything about vaccines, consider it a win. But he was great on this show. And at the end, though, what happened was he asked me, so it's out there. You're in the pocket of industry. I mean, how do you respond to it? So I said, you know, I'm not in the pocket of industry. I mean, if anything, I'm sort of in the pocket of children, because we do this and this at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And 300 people in the studio audience booed loudly. So I didn't understand this, and I'll tell you why in a second, but he was great. He could have left it at that. He could have just had me be embarrassed publicly on national television. He said, that's not the answer you want. I'll ask you the same question again, and then we'll go out with this answer. So he asked it again. I said, you can, on the one hand, praise vaccines for being safe and effective, and not at some level praise those who make them safe and effective. And then I did something you were specifically told not to do, which is I looked at the studio audience and said, was that any better? And they cheered. So, you know, when this is not a live show, it's live to tape, as they say. So it was edited where basically I said something nice about vaccine makers and people cheered for the first time probably in network television. But when I was leaving, I asked the woman who was the associate producer, why had people booed? And she said, you know, people like you forget that you're on a comedy show. When you said that you were in the pocket of children, it made you sound like a pedophile. So, as we were going back to the this was in New York, so we were going back to the train station to go come back to Philly that night, I asked my wife and daughter, you know, would you ever have imagined that? And my daughter said, yeah, I imagined that. That's why I booed. Samantha Bee took on, in this case, Sarah Pope, who was a health and nutrition blogger. And again, her strategy was where sort of Stephen Colbert kind of played the anti-vaccine activist. Samantha Bee just took one on directly and, you know, sort of challenged her for a number of her assumptions and clearly just recoiled at some of the things that she said. This was pretty brave, I think. I was also on this show. And, you know, when she came to... to my laboratory, I actually hadn't seen, I'm embarrassed to say, I had never actually seen Samantha Bee. I didn't know who she was. When I asked my children whether or not I should be on this show, they said, definitely. I mean, everybody watches The Daily Show. She's great. What? Go on this show, definitely. And when she was there with, you know, a couple camera people and other producers and stuff, and I thought she was the producer when I first met her. And she just struck me as very quiet and shy and introverted, you know, because I can read women. I don't know what it is. It's like a special gift or something. But you know, she was a wild woman. They actually bring two cameras to the interview, one to sort of just see your reactions. So at one point, she just sort of threw her hands to her head, jumped up and screamed, WTF, and then ran out of the room. And it just, you know, so they can get your expression. This is how it works. So you have to sort of, if you're willing to do this, if you want to get out there and try and communicate science, you have to be willing to put aside any residual pride that you have after 25 years of the NIH granting process and do it. And Jimmy Kimmel, I don't know if you've seen this one. This is one of the best 10 minutes against sort of as a diatribe against the anti-vaccine folks, I think, that's ever been on television. It was great. But what he did was he had a series of pediatricians in Southern California basically just screaming at the top of their lungs at their frustration of having people reject a arguably life-saving measure, vaccines. It was, and they weren't kidding. I mean, if you watch this show, you'd be really impressed by how truly angry they were. And given their level of frustration, I don't think they were kidding. So I'm coming to the end here. I think there are some also very hopeful signs. I think if you can say nothing about the Trump administration, you really can say pretty much nothing about the Trump administration. It's good. But, I mean, I think one thing you could say is he has gotten us off our butts. I mean, more people have marched, I think, since he's been in office than ever before in American history, which was true for the March for Science. Right. So on April 22nd, 2017, in 400 cities in the U.S. and 600 in the world, from the Washington Monument to the Brandenburg Gate to Greenland, millions of people marched for science. Carrying signs and banners, it was a staggeringly compelling moment. And these are just some pictures from that event. I don't know if you remember the March for Science, but here in Philly, it was raining. There were still like 20,000 people that eventually marched down to Penn Landing, but there were some great signs. This is one, I can't believe I'm marching for facts. This one, so bad, even the introverts are here. And then for those of you who remember the Vietnam War protests, what do we want? Peace. When do we want it? Now. Okay, well, what do we want? Evidence-based science. When do we want it? After peer review. I love that. So this is my last slide. I think that I think as scientists or clinicians, we really need to stand up now more than ever. I think there's no venue that's too small. I think we should, whenever we see bad information, we need to not let it go untransmitted. And everybody, I mean, all of us at some level are scientists. I mean, are logical, ordered, hierarchical thinkers who can tell good information from bad information. I think we all need to stand up. I think now more than ever, I think we shouldn't assume other people are doing it. For me personally, I was funded by the National Institutes of Health for 25 years to work on, as Dr. Arkush said, a rotavirus vaccine. Who paid me? I mean, it was the taxpayer that paid me, and they can just as easily decide not to pay people like us to do that kind of work. So I'll just close with one story in terms of no venue is too small. When my daughter was in the eighth grade, she went to a school in suburban Philadelphia, and the teacher asked me to come out and sort of talk about vaccines. I thought this was going to be really fun. My daughter didn't. She was mortified. I mean, the entire drive to school that morning, she said, "Don't make jokes, Dad. People my age don't get old people's jokes. They're not going to think you're funny. Don't do it." And so I went, honestly, it's the most harrowing talk I've ever given. I'm including the Colbert Report in that. I mean, this was worse. So I gave, you know, this talk. 19 girls seemed to be enjoying it. One didn't. She was just sort of staring grimly forward with a look on her face that said, "Do not embarrass me in front of my friends." If you embarrass your daughter in front of your eighth grade friends, and this is why I think it was more challenging than anything I've done, is, you know, you're a dead man. You're a walking dead man. So it was clearly the hardest thing I've ever done. But thanks for your attention. I'll stop there. So there's a bunch of questions here. You want to start with this, the gentleman right here? Yeah.
I don't want to personalize this, but the person's name has to be used, but I'd like you to try to unwind what's grown up about this, Robert Kennedy. And so, I mean, he's held up by the anti-vaxxers as an anti-vaxxer, although he obviously says he's vaccinated all of his children. I think all of us were horrified when he went to Trump Tower to talk to Trump. So can you sort of unwind this nexus of how he's become enmeshed in this and how people like him are used by one side or the other?
Right, so Robert Kennedy Jr., the son of Robert Kennedy, is he's an anti-vaccine activist. He's the head of something called the World Mercury Project. He is of the belief that the ethyl mercury-containing preservative, there wasn't a number of vaccines, but now is largely gone. Yeah, so sorry, ethyl mercury-containing preservative called thimerosal is largely out of vaccines, but he believes that this was causing harm, and he has made this his crusade. I don't know why he continues to ignore the science that has exonerated this. I think the data have clearly, a truth has clearly emerged from study after study after study. There have been seven now studies that have shown that you're at no greater risk of even subtle sort of mercury toxicities if you've gotten these vaccines or if you didn't, which makes sense from the biology because you have far more mercury just in the environment. He doesn't believe that. I don't know what his motivation is. I know that he is of counsel to the law firm of Morgan & Morgan. He was of counsel to the law firm of Levin Papantonio. These are law firms that are involved in class action lawsuits, and maybe that's part of this. I don't know. I mean, it's frustrating. He actually called me once to talk about this issue in an article that he eventually wrote for the Rolling Stone magazine, and it was just full of inaccuracies. I mean, I thought it was great. I thought I actually had a great long phone conversation with Robert Kennedy Jr. And I remember coming. I don't know. I mean, when we had that conversation, just as a sort of a light on a window to this, I think when we had that conversation, I thought he had said to me, I have mothers who've come to me who are worried about this. I'm trying to understand the science of this. Could you explain this to me? And I probably talked to him for an hour on the phone. I mean, I thought, great, I am going to be having touch football games in Hyannisport soon. Okay, this is all going to work out. No, and he sandbagged me. I mean, he ultimately published a paper or an article in Rolling Stone magazine, again, not one of the great medical or scientific journals, claiming, you know, it was called deadly immunity, and it had a series of misstatements. I mean, not the least of which was that our rotavirus vaccine contained thimerosal, which it doesn't. And so, and a number of things. I mean, I was just, in his mind, I was just working for the pharmaceutical companies because our vaccine, the vaccine we developed at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, was quote-unquote laced with thimerosal. So I called the editor of Rolling Stone, and I said, or at least the person who was involved with this piece, and said, there are a number of misstatements in this article, and he just kept saying, you know, we stand by our story. This sort of, you know, channeling Ben Bradley, you know, this, you know, we stand by our story. But you know, Ben Bradley was right to stand by his story. I mean, the story was wrong. He could have easily shown it was wrong in 5 minutes by just looking at package inserts, and they just stood by it. It just really, they ultimately it was retracted, but it was. I don't know. I don't understand it. He has a powerful position because of his name. He could do a lot of good, and he's choosing to do harm. I don't know why.
As a pediatrician for 40 years, I can certainly identify with the pediatricians who were screaming about how vaccines are denied by parents. What is my own feeling after all these years is that a lot of it comes down to science education in the elementary school, in the high school. I'd like your thoughts on that, that this is how we teach people what scientific method is and how to evaluate facts, because just as this gentleman said about Robert Kennedy, the facts don't seem to matter to people.
Yeah, I wish I had an easy answer to that. I certainly agree that we probably could be better at trying to educate about the tenets of the scientific method, about what science, what the method allows us to say and what it doesn't allow us to say. But I think we're just in a different time. This notion of simply proudly declaring your own truths, even though they're at directly contradictory to everything that we know. I mean, if you look, the thing that's the most, take, you know, evolution. I mean, you have to deny 250,000 years of fossil records to believe that man and the apes didn't evolve from a common ancestor. Yet the head of the Secretary of the Department of Education does do this. That's the Secretary of the Department of Education. It's painful. I think all we can do is to try and get the facts out there as in the most compelling, passionate, and compassionate way that we do, to make it a story, to make it fun, to make it clear, to make it also clear that there are things at stake. I mean, obviously denying climate change puts us at great risk, and we just have to make that clear. We have to tell a powerful story. Because I think we're humans and we're compelled by story, and so we have to be able to tell a more powerful story. We can do that. I think we can do that. I mean, you look at like the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science in D.C., 120,000 scientists belong to that organization. I mean, that's the organization that publishes Science magazine. That's a great sales force. But I think we don't feel that we're compelled to get out there and do it. We think other people are doing it, and they're not. We're not very good at it. It's certainly out of our comfort zone. Believe me, this has been way out of my comfort zone. But, you know, I think you have no choice but to do it, because if you don't do it, then you know, we have much to lose.
This is personal. My first granddaughter is 8 and a half, and for 8 and a half years, I have been carrying this burden because my daughter has not vaccinated my 8 and a half year old and the 6-year-old. And I would ask her why, and it seems that her husband's family also feel this way, because when he was a baby and he had one of his shots, his temperature shot up to 105, and they had to take him out in the snow to get the temperature down. And I said to her, well, the same thing happened to my son, and I put him in some ice water and he recovered, but it wasn't because of the vaccination, it was because of a virus. And I walk around with this, and she says, we're in discussions now with the doctor, with her pediatrician, and I am so scared that they're putting their children in harm's way, and I love these kids. And my whole family would walk around like shaking when we were around her. She took them to Disney World, and I asked her to please get them vaccinated before they went to Disney World, because the world comes to Disney World. Well, they were lucky because nothing happened. What do I do? How do I get this person? You know, how do I get my daughter, who I love very much, and I adore my grandchildren, how do I get her to see the light?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, and arguably an unanswerable one. I think that, you know, you just do the best you can. I mean, I would say that, that I get calls every day from parents who have questions about vaccines. I would say 85% of the time they smell the smoke, they want to know whether there's any fire there, and they are reassurable. You find out what it is that they're worried about. You explain to them either why biologically it doesn't make sense, or how there are now data showing that their concerns should be alleviated. But some people just have this fear, and it's an irrational fear, but it's one they hold onto very tightly, and it doesn't matter what you say to them. They're not going to be convinced. And, you know, you live in a country where you can choose not to vaccinate your children. You know, 47 states have religious exemptions to vaccines, 17 states have philosophical exemptions to vaccines. You can make that choice. Does it put you at your child at risk? Yes. Does it put those with whom they come in contact with at risk? Yes, because not all vaccines, or no vaccines, are 100% effective. So I don't know. I mean, I think you just have to make it as clear as one can that a choice not to get a vaccine is not a risk-free choice. It's a choice to take a different and more serious risk, and you shouldn't play that game. You shouldn't play the game of Russian roulette. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example at our hospital. We saw a child at 2, 4, and 6 months of age. The parents had recently converted to Muslim. They had vaccinated their older children, but they had chosen not to vaccinate this child. And so not that there's anything in the Muslim religion that says don't get vaccinated, but this was their belief. So we agreed. I mean, we didn't, you know, because there are religious exemptions to vaccinations in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, we just continued to see this child. So at some level, tacitly, we were agreeing that what they were doing. At 11 months of age, the child got a bacterial meningitis caused by a bacteria called pneumococcus. There was a vaccine for that. And the serotype, the particular type of pneumococcus he had, would have been prevented by that vaccine. He had a bad case of meningitis. His brains pressed down on his brain stem, so-called herniation. We intubated him and saved his life, but he will never see, walk, speak, or hear again. This was a normal child whose arguably 70 or 80 or 90-year-old life was snuffed out by a terrible decision, a decision that was based on bad information. And so, at the very least, I think when especially young pediatricians who also don't see these diseases today, and so are less compelled by them, I think they have to be willing to be much more strident about what's at stake here. I think vaccines are largely a victim of their own success. I mean, you didn't have to convince my parents to vaccinate us. I mean, they were children in the 20s and 30s. They saw diphtheria as a common killer of teenagers. They saw polio as a crippler of children and young adults. You didn't have to convince me to vaccinate my children. I mean, I had measles, I had mumps, I had rubella, I had varicella, I had all those diseases. I know what they felt like. But my children, our children who are 25 and 23, they didn't grow up with these diseases. They don't see these diseases today. They're far less compelled by them. I'd like to believe they're going to vaccinate their children, but that's going to be my guess on that. But, it's just, and it's also true of young clinicians who also aren't as compelled by these diseases because they didn't see them. I mean, when somebody with a fever and a rash comes into our hospital, I'm also often, asked to come down and take a look because I have seen so much measles, whereas many young physicians haven't seen measles, which is remarkable when you consider that every year we'd have 3.5 to 4 million cases of measles, 48,000 children would be hospitalized, and 500 to 1,000 would die from a disease that that's now preventable because of a man named Maurice Hilleman, and we are actually fortunate to have in the audience here tonight Maurice Hilleman's wife, Lorraine Hilleman, who's sitting right here. I think there's time for one more question. You want to do it from this? You want to go with this gentleman here on the end?
First off, I already read Bad Advice, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thanks for saying that.
Would you be in favor of CHOP or another hospital or pediatricians refusing to treat children whose parents don't vaccinate them?
Right. So that's the $64,000 question. I mean, what to do? What do you do if you're a pediatrician? On the one hand, you want to do the best you can to try and, you're the child's advocate. You want to do the best you can to get that child a vaccine. If you choose not to see them, what happens to them? Where do they go? Do they go to a chiropractor who's perfectly willing not to vaccinate? Do they go to another pediatrician who's maybe perfectly willing not to vaccinate? What happens? And I don't know the answer. I watch my wife, who's a general pediatrician, go through this. And I think once she felt that once they drew the kind of line you're talking about, where you say, look, this is how important this is to me. If you can't vaccinate your child according to the schedule so that I know that they're in the safest position possible, I can't have them walk out of this room knowing that they're at risk. Let me love your child. Don't put me in a position where I'm asked to practice substandard care, where this child could get measles or whooping cough or mumps. There were 6,000 cases of mumps last year. I can't do that. And what she found, and this was with a sort of upper middle class suburban practice, was that was much more convincing because they saw how important it was to her that they were willing to draw a line. But if you're willing to draw, if you want to draw the line, you have to realize that somebody may say no and walk away, and then you have no chance. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I do think that certainly there are increasing numbers of pediatricians who are making that choice, in part because they have responsibility to the waiting room. If you have more and more children in the waiting room who are unvaccinated, knowing that there are going to be children in that waiting room who are, say, on steroids for their rheumatologic diseases or that they're on chemotherapy for their cancers, I mean, those people can't get vaccinated. When California eliminated its philosophical exemption, thus becoming the third state in the union to have only a medical exemption, no philosophical exemption, no religious exemption. When they did that, when they had so-called Senate Bill 277, what turned the tide was a little 5-year-old boy who had leukemia, who was in the midst of his therapy, and he would go to these meetings and he would stand up, he would sort of go get on a stool because he couldn't reach the microphone, and then he would say, "What about me? Don't I count? I depend on you to protect me." And that made a difference. So, I mean, but it's a societal argument. And I think it's hard to make a societal argument these days. People are more selfish. All right, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.